The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Matter Private Network. During current restrictions, don't ignore your health concerns. Our expert team is ready to help.
Over 35 years in Dáil Éireann, I have developed a deep affection for this house and its traditions. I recall the great figures who have passed through its portals in my time and who are no longer with us. I remember vividly the many important parliamentary occasions this House has witnessed through the years. Dáil Éireann is the democratic forum of this nation, to establish which our forefathers made many sacrifices and of which they would be proud. I would urge all deputies to continue to stand up for and enhance the standing of the Dáil and the status of its members, and to foster a sense of pride in all our democratic institutions. The work of government and the Dáil must always be directed to the progress of the nation, and I hope that I have been able to provide some leadership to that end in my time. I have always sought to act solely and exclusively in the best interest of the Irish people. I might quote perhaps Othello. I have done the state some service. They know it. No more of that.
And that was a rather dignified end to the political life of Charles Haughey as he addressed Dáil Éireann almost 30 years ago. But as a comprehensive new biography points out, it was a political life containing power struggles, scandals, tax evasion, corruption, and one of the most fascinating legacies in all of Irish politics. Haughey is the book, and its author, Professor of Politics at DCU's School of Law and Government, Gary Murphy, joins me now. Gary, good morning.
Hi, Pat. Thanks for having me.
Now, what a book. It's hard to know where to start, but he is a fascinating figure. But the funny thing is that he doesn't resonate with a younger generation of voters the way he resonates clearly with you and with me.
Yeah, I often ask my current students, and when I was writing this book over the course of the last decade, I would say to them, you know, Charles Haughey, what does he mean to you? And some of them would say, wasn't there sort of something to do with corruption? And then some of people would say, oh, wasn't there something to do with an affair? And then some people, slightly more informed students, would say, oh, Fianna Fáil, but no, look at Fianna Fáil, it's like not the party of Haughey. Yeah, and the legacy, as you say, is it's certainly a complex and somewhat contested still, I think. And yeah, he is a fascinating figure, and once his papers were lodged in the university, I was of course sort of instantly drawn to him, and I had studied him for years even before embarking on it.
The mystery of Charles Haughey, I mean, there were many mysteries. He married Sean Lemass's daughter. It would appear that he had Fine Gael connections in his family before moving over to the other side, as it were. He became wealthy rather quickly, and people still wonder to this day, where did the money come from? Do you have any insight?
Yeah, well, first on the family. Yeah, his father was invalided, to use the word then in use, out of the army in 1928. He was a Collins man, you know, and here we are on the sort of 100th anniversary of the signing of the treaty just the other day. And he was very much a free stater. Collins, there was a picture of Collins in the house in Donnycarney. But Haughey's sort of childhood friends in Donnycarney, and certainly when he went to UCD in the... in the early 1940s, they were Fianna Fáil people, including Maureen Lemass. And I try to debunk what I think is the view that Haughey married Maureen Lemass, you know, for advancement in Fianna Fáil. It certainly didn't harm him, and in fact, it probably did him much good. His father-in-law came to recognise his talents. But anyone who suggests that Maureen Lemass would have married Charles Haughey because it was doing him a favour certainly didn't know her, and I think it denies her agency. I interviewed her right at the beginning of my work back in 2014, and she was a very powerful woman in and of herself. Now, she kind of kept the politics separate. And in relation to the money, there's been some very good work on Haughey and money, including Colm Keane's book of a couple of decades ago, Haughey's Millions. We know money money he had was put into the Ansbacher account. He always said that this trainer had control of his accounts, but we also know that Haughey certainly had a very aggressive dealings personally with AIB in the 1970s before he became a leader of Fianna Fáil and Taoiseach, and said he could be a very significant opponent that he that they wouldn't want to have. Now, in his in his papers, there is a note where he. Where it's suggested to him by Martin Manser and others that the defence he should take was that, you know, he wouldn't have been the only person to have difficulties with the banks. Now, I wasn't able to trace to any great length who gave him the money beyond what the Tribunal of Inquiry, the Moriarty Tribunal and McCracken beforehand, and of course, like a sort of a lonely professor, they had the power of the state, but he certainly, you know, amassed many millions and was living way beyond his means. He lived by his chequebook. And that was the threat that AIB said to him, that they were going to take his chequebook off him. But all the art he collected in Abbeville, the money for Inish Ficklaw, like he was £600,000 in debt in 1974, when he bought Inish Ficklaw for £25,000. So he lived by his chequebook. It was certainly a different era.
But so he wasn't necessarily dripping in millions, but still he had to. I know there was buying and selling of property early
on.
But you know the money seemed to have multiplied at a rate that even the Celtic Tiger couldn't have imagined. So. Just that mystery, where did that early money come from?
Well, he first of all he lived on the Holt Road in Raheny. And he sold that by Grangemore, and then he sold Grangemore to move into Abbeville, and he made quite a significant amount of money when he bought Abbeville. Now Abbeville was a tremendous, as you know, past the James Gandon design and mansion. Now he had to do a lot of work to that property when he bought it in 1969, but he made a lot of money from as I said, from the selling of Grangemore, and there was some controversy over rezoning of that land. I treat that to some I treat that some lint in the book. I mean, there is no great evidence of impropriety in that particular sale, at least from my investigations. And certainly, Haughey was, I think, from the late 1960s, gaining or getting money from, you know, wealthy men. He always said that he all this was done. To allow him to live the sort of the life where he could devote it simply to politics. But as the more
was there any suggestion? Do you remember Taka?
I do, and I this write was about the
you do indeed the fundraising arm. Whether or not that money went to the party or to the man.
Well, again, as far as we can tell, Taka went to the party because Haughey wasn't in control of the finances of the Fianna Fáil party in the 1960s, as he was much later when he became Taoiseach. And Taka is very controversial, of course, because it does link Fianna Fáil with the sort of burgeoning business elite of the 1960s. Lemass himself, you know, he wasn't opposed to Taka, although people like De Valera, Frank Aiken, Sean McEntee were. And there is a split in Fianna Fáil around money, because Fianna Fáil, as you know, again, was the sort of, or they view themselves as the party of the working man, the party that attracted support from all classes. Not just the moneyed classes, and how he wanted to change that certainly, and you know he probably did, but the evidence of impropriety in the 1960s is not there, I think.
Now the two other talking points that inevitably come up when you discuss Charles Haughey would be Terry Keane, his longtime mistress. And the arms trial. Now, we've had revisionism on the arms trial. Certainly Michael Heaney's book was very informative on that. And you would go along with Michael's analysis.
I would. I mean, Michael Heaney's book is very, very comprehensive, and it covers, you know, in tremendous detail, a kind of a period of 2 years. I covered the arms trial in two full chapters. So it's not as detailed, obviously, as Michael's book, because I'm covering the full life. But the evidence in Haughey's own papers, and I had access to these papers, Pat, in DCU, and we'll be opening up these in the new year to other researchers and the public, you know, COVID permitting and whatnot, and we'll be releasing them in transit. That's mostly to do with his defence. I mean, there is no letter to say that he knew that arms were being imported in Austria, via Austria in 1969. And certainly, you know, some of the critics of the book have said the idea that Hawke wouldn't have known is far-fetched. And I think that is reasonable enough. But I don't think there is any substantive evidence to show that Hawke and Neil Blaney were running some sort of alternative government to Jack Lynch in 1969, when the Troubles do erupt. Now, certainly, Hawke and Blaney were in charge of a fund. We know that, and Michael Heaney again goes into great detail there. But, you know, if not quite exonerate Hawke, I certainly am not convinced that Hawke was running a parallel government.
I mean, the contention is that Jack Lynch and Jim Gibbons actually knew. And
that is the contention. And I would go along with that to much of an extent. The point I would make, you know, and I think this is an important point in relation to Hawke. Hawke knew Barry for a decade. He had worked with Barry when he was first of all parliamentary private secretary in justice, and then when Hawke was a very, you know, I think substantive reforming minister of justice, the Succession Act, the abolition of the death penalty, and a whole variety of things. And I think the idea that Hawke would have thought that Barry would leave illegal arms be imported into the state is really far-fetched. I mean, all we know of Barry, and I think all we know of Hawke, is that Hawke knew Barry would not turn a blind eye. And I think that's been sort of missed by many commentators of the arms trade. Now, it's a tremendously murky business to this day. I mean, we also had David Burke's book, Deception and Lies, which is very critical of Lynch and Gibbons in particular. And I suppose what I was trying to do, Pat, was to think about how Hawke thought about these issues. You know, I tried to humanise him throughout the book beyond the caricature, you know, he has sort of become. But on the arms trial, you know, and again, I think this is very important, he was the only parliamentarian to face trial. Neil Blaney had been acquitted no charges were pressed against him by a lower court, and Hawke felt tremendously hard done by both the Attorney General, Colm Condon, and also by Jack Lynch. And he always blamed Lynch, Gibbons to a lesser extent, for the fact that he had gone on trial and would have, if convicted, faced up to, I think, 10 years in jail. Now, it would depend obviously on the leniency of the judge, but they were very, you know, very grim times for Hawke.
Now, the other element, Terry Keane, who famously went on The Late Late Show and with Gay, and subsequently came on with me. And that whole chapter, I mean, talk about the dogs in the street being aware of something and everybody just not publicly talking about it. It wouldn't happen today, I think, in spite of, you know, people's rights to privacy. But you think of what happened to Dominic Raab in Britain and so on. It would certainly get out there. That relationship, why did it remain out of the public domain for so long?
Yeah, well, I think obviously the libel laws certainly were sort of one part of it. And there was, I think, maybe you might actually, you probably would know more than me, Pat, than this. There was certainly a view, I think, among some in the chattering classes and maybe in the journalistic classes, that this was a private thing, as I think from a public thing. I'm not interested in the book in the sort of, I suppose one might call it the tawdry details, but I devote some time to it because I think it's clearly very important. And she was an important part of his life, unquestionably. They met in 1972. The affair lasted until 1999, when she went on the Late Late Show in May of that year. She said to Gay Byrne, to Terry Keane, this is, that Hawke knew she was coming on and didn't mind. He knew she was going on, but he certainly minded very much, as far as I can and tell, and asked her not to do it the day before when they met in Le Coq Hardy in Dublin. But the point about everybody knowing, Pat, I'm not sure that is really true as well. Now, this was in the Sunday Independent constantly for, you know, a couple of decades, but at the time not everybody read the Sunday Independent. Media wasn't as all pervasive as it is now. And there are
she used to refer to him as Sweetie.
Oh, I know that, yeah, but I'm saying
in the column. And I mean, one of the, if there's one thing I looked for in the book, it was Dermot Morgan and Scrap Saturday. I think was hugely influential in sort of bringing all of that into the light of day.
That's true. I don't write about Scrap Saturday, although I probably should have. And you know, I was very upset at being sort of lampooned. But obviously, when the affair became known again, that was a also a tremendously difficult time for Haughey, because at the same time the tribunals were on his case, and there was the potential of a criminal trial for misleading the tribunal. And of course, he had been diagnosed with cancer just 5 years earlier in 1994. I mean, I do make the point in the book that this was a meaningful relationship. This wasn't some sort of, you know, scatterbrain thing. It was meaningful. It was long lasting. I don't think he was ever going to leave Maureen. I also don't think, and Terry Keane said this, that, you know, at one stage in the early 1980s, they were thinking of, Haughey was thinking of going to France with her. Everything we know about Haughey suggested he was, you know, politics was his life, basically. It consumed him. And I think the idea that he would have left public life in his sort of mid-50s at that age really it doesn't quite stand up. I'm quite critical, I suppose, of her when she did the Late Late Show interview with you, and then she regretted doing the Late Late Show interview with Gay Byrne. She told you that she regretted the original interview. But then when he was literally, he was buried on a Friday, and then on that Sunday, Ireland and Sunday had a big, huge splash across four pages, I think, with very intimate photographs of her and him, of Haughey and Keane. And that seemed to me sort of, you know, a bit much, yeah, considering he was literally only dead in the car, cold in the grave.
Well, Gary, it's an extraordinary book, terrific book, fascinating book
so much,
to read.
It
is published by Gill Books, a huge hardback, a very handsome hardback with lots of photographs as well.
Yeah.
Gary, thank you very much for joining us. By the way, just a postscript, I met Charles Haughey after he had retired at some Christmas drinks. I think Eddie Jordan was hosting them. And I said to him, "You're in the wars," because the tribunals were after him. And he said, "I don't know what they're at. I mean, I am retired."
just to finish on the retirement, I mean, he expected his retirement would be very sort of sedate, and of course it was full of storms and turmoil. Yeah.
All right, Gary, once again, congratulations
thank
on the book,
Pat.
And thank you very much for joining us. It's simply called Haughey.